Last week we began to have a discussion about the importance of tradition, the importance of Mesorah and Minhagim. And I got a lot of very positive feedback that people felt it was a important discussion about how to understand the fundamentals of what it is that we do as God-fearing and religious Orthodox Jews. Given that many people felt there's a lack of understanding of what it is that Mesorah represents, and that's what we discussed last week, began to discuss, I thought before we get into the strict letter of the law, the halacha, we try to talk a little bit more in a follow-up to last week, to begin to appreciate as well what it is that the Mesorah means to all of us, what it means that tradition is supposed to mean to all of us in our lives. So let's begin with the following. We begin with a very famous piece that Rav Soloveitchik wrote, and it's a piece that he wrote about Mrs. Twersky, who was his machatenister. I've been told that there's no English word for that. So it's a famous piece that he wrote, and it was printed subsequently in Tradition 1978. And it's a very beautiful read, and I'm sure snippets of this we've seen before and we've read before, but to see it in its entirety, again, this is not the whole piece, but this is most of the important parts of the piece, I think really brings home the point of what tradition and what Mesorah is meant to be. Rav Soloveitchik describes it in his opinion, what he thinks the Mesorah actually is. So let's begin like this. Rav Soloveitchik, again, is giving a hesped for a woman who he was very close with, who he had tremendous regard from, as you will see. So he writes as follows, if you should address this embarrassing question to me, meaning if you would ask me, what did she represent and why am I giving a hesped on her? Why am I taking up my time and why am I going so much out of my way to speak about her tremendous virtues and values? He said, I would answer the following. She was an unusual woman. If you should continue to cross-examine me and insist that I clarify my use of the term unusual, what does it mean to be unusual? I would say that she was unusual because she belonged to an unusual community. I'm sorry. What does it mean to belong to an unusual community? Not many women today are qualified for admission to that strange society. The Rebbetzin, meaning Mrs. Twersky, was qualified and did belong to that mysterious society. So what is this mysterious, strange, unusual community that he's referring to? What is the name of that mysterious society? It is the Mesorah Society, as he calls it, which was founded by Moshe Rabbeinu at the dawn of our history, and which at the point of, let's try to get this right, eschatological fulfillment of our history, will be joined by the Melech HaMashiach. That's what it means to be a part of the Mesorah Society. We connect ourselves back to Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's a link, that's a Mesorah that we continue to follow until the Melech HaMashiach will come. What characterizes that society? So what exactly does it mean to be a part of this Mesorah community that we all consider ourselves a part of? Number one, it means to have an unqualified dedication to learning and teaching. To always understand the need to learn and to teach that which we have learned. Its motto is, teach and let yourself be taught. Not to live with arrogance as if we have understood everything there is to understand, that we have mastered everything there is to know in all areas of life and in Torah and in Hashkafa, but to be a perpetual learner and teacher at the same time. It demands that every Jew be simultaneously a teacher and a pupil, that every member of the society hold on with one hand to an old teacher, which so often has been forgotten in our generation. So many have neglected the old teachers. What do they have to say? They're out of touch. What can we learn from them? While the other hand rests upon the frail shoulders of a young pupil. That is the obligation of anyone who is attached to a Mesorah. To attach themselves, number one, to an older teacher who has experience, who understands what it is to live life to the fullest, and to appreciate what the Mesorah meant to them, what the tradition was in their own lives, while at the same time having an absolute resolve that we will pass that on to our young pupils. This society, which represents the very essence of Judaism, cuts across the ages and millennia and holds the key to our miraculous survival. You want to know why we're still here? You want to know why there have been so many factions of the Jewish people over the years, and you've had the Kusim and the Karaim and the Tzedukim and so many offshoots of Orthodox and religious Jewry that have gone in different directions and may have started off very powerful. You want to know why they're not here, says Rav Soloveitchik. It's because they don't attach themselves to a Mesorah. Why should there be a continuity if you don't represent any level, any form of continuity? If you don't represent anything greater than yourself, why should your children be interested in following in that path? They can outsmart you. They can learn more than you. They can study harder than you. They can be more intellectual than you are. They could be more adventurous. What should keep them going? For anyone who has followed the Pew Report, we understand this to be true, unfortunately. It's extremely unfortunate that we're losing so many Jews, and I think it's the most painful report that has come out in the last number of years. I don't know why so many Orthodox Jews were happy about it. I think it's what to be very sad about. There were so many people who wrote that it was making them very happy to see, look, so many other factions are dying out. It's so sad. You know why they're dying out? Because so many are intermarrying. Because they don't see the value of the Mesorah. And that, said Rav Soloveitchik, is the key to our miraculous survival, is to connect ourselves to that Mesorah community and to all that it represents. Let's continue. Last paragraph on the first sheet, on the first column. On the long Shabbos afternoons in the summer, we preface the recital of Pirkei Avos with a declaration concerning our total involvement in the Mesorah community. Moshe received the Torah from Har Sinai. He handed it to Yehoshua. Yehoshua gave it to the Zakenim. The Zakenim gave it to the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im handed it down to the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah. In other words, Judaism expresses itself through the Shalsheles HaKabbalah. That's what it's all about. This is how we introduce Pirkei Avos. It's all about the Shalsheles HaKabbalah, the Shalsheles HaMesorah, the chain of tradition. Hands are linked and generations are united. When we learn from an older teacher who represents that Shalsheles HaKabbalah, who upholds that Shalsheles HaMesorah, it means we are learning from Moshe Rabbeinu. It means he is present. It means Yehoshua ben Nun is there. It means all that came in between Moshe Rabbeinu, Yehoshua, the Zakenim, and all those greats from all the millennia and all the generations are there. When we study, when we present the Torah that we all uphold in our generation, it's such a powerful imagery. And it's what has kept the Jewish people alive. That hands are linked and generations are united. One society encompasses past, present, and future. And as I mentioned before, admission to that society is a difficult and complex affair. Not everyone is able to appreciate what that means. And we are blessed to live in a community that we do know what it means. That we do uphold a Mesorah and a Minhag. That we do understand and appreciate how much it's the fundamental of all that we do and all that we believe in. Fortunate is the person who met the requirements of admission and was accepted. Fortunate was the Rebbetzin who did meet the requirements and was admitted to that exclusive and strange society. So what exactly does the Mesorah mean? So he's told us that we represent something that goes all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. That every time we speak, we are speaking not on behalf of ourselves, but we're studying the Torah, we are presenting that which represents millennia and so many generations. But what exactly does it mean? We're in the middle of the second column. People are mistaken in thinking that there is only one Mesorah and one Mesorah community, the community of the fathers. And someone very correctly pointed out last night, he doesn't mean here father versus mother. Someone said last night that now we have a very different system and fathers and mothers' roles are changing, as we know. So take this in the context of he's describing the way he grew up. And he doesn't mean specifically father versus mother. He means we have two Mesorahs that we always have to pay attention to. And you'll understand what I mean in a minute. People are mistaken in thinking that there is only one Mesorah and one Mesorah community, the community of the fathers. And it is not true. We have two Mesorahs, two traditions, two communities, two Shalsheles HaKabbalah. The Mesorah community of the fathers and that of the mothers. So what does he mean? What is the difference between those two mesoros, between those two traditions? What is the distinction between Musar Avicha and Toras Imecha? What does the pasuk mean when it tells us, listen to the Musar Avicha and to the Toras Imecha? Is that not the same thing? Let us explore what one learns from the father and what one learns from the mother. One learns much from father, and he's describing here what he learned from his beloved father. How to read a text, the Bible or the Talmud. How to comprehend, how to analyze, how to conceptualize, how to classify, how to infer, how to apply. Meaning he learned critical thinking from his father. He learned how to approach any issue, any matter of halacha. That's what he learned from his father. One also learns from father what to do and what not to do. What is morally right and what is morally wrong. Father teaches the son the discipline of thought as well as the discipline of action. Father's tradition is an intellectual and moral one. So then what is the Toras Imecha? What else is there if the father seems to have taught everything there is to know? What kind of Torah does the mother pass on? And again, here he's describing what kind of Torah his mother passed on to him. I admit that I am not able to define precisely the Masoretic role of the Jewish mother. I am scripted to be able to explain it. So permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. Listen to the description that he gives of his mother. It's so distant from the picture that we have, I don't know, but the picture I have of my mother, as much as I respect her. But listen to the picture that he's giving over of what his mother meant to him. What did she talk about? I must use a halachic term in order to answer this question. She talked me'inyana diyoma. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sidra every Friday night. I don't have a picture of my mother doing that. This is something he got from his mother. He used to watch his mother go over the Parsha every Friday night. And I still remember the nostalgic tune. I learned from her very much. Here's a very important line. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. So my father taught me all the strict letter of the law. I went through all of Shas with him, and he taught me how to be a critical thinker and how to approach a sugya and halacha and how to paskin a shayla. And my mother taught me, most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law. That's not all Judaism is. Judaism is nothing if that's all you have. What he learned from his mother is that Judaism is also a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and a warmth to mitzvahs. I learned from her the most important thing in life. Now, if you would have met Rav Soloveitchik and listened or read anything that he's written, you would say he was so influenced by his father. Look at the brilliance from the Soloveitchik family. Look how much he transmitted in every shir that he gave. He set over from his father and his grandfather, and he shared so much of what he learned from them and how much they shaped his train of thinking. But here he writes, I learned from her the most important thing in life. Which means all that I learned from my father paled in comparison to this, which I learned from my mother. To feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. That's the most important thing in life. And that's what he learned from his mother. It's something that was not communicated by his father. Because that's the second Mesorah that's necessary to work co-jointly with the first. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive, totally out of touch with what Judaism expects of us, had he not had his mother. You think about the origins of the movement of Hasidus. Hasidus was started for a very simple reason. Hasidus was started because how many people in that generation were able to afford to have a Malamed teach them anything? Almost no one. It was an elite few who were able to go to yeshiva and become educated and have a Malamed who was going to spend time with them. So we were losing the Medes. What was a child supposed to do? At 5 or 10 years old, they went out to work. They had no background. They were illiterate. They had nothing to keep them holding on to their religion, to the tradition. And the greats of that generation realized, we have a major problem. We have a major problem. Because we're losing so many of our people. Not because they don't want to be religious, but because they simply don't know what being religious even means. They have never been educated. How should they know? And that's why the movement began. And the emphasis of Hasidus at the time was Simcha. Why was it Simcha? Why was it Tefillah? Not because that's more important than anything else, but because we have to figure out how to latch people in. How can we get them in? We have to give them the experience and the feeling of warmth of what our tradition represents, of what our religion means to us. Without that, how can we ever have any meaningful experience? And the opposition at the time was not to the fact that religion has to have feeling. The opposition was, well, don't forget about the whole other component, which was keeping to the strict letter of the law as well. And probably the rationale for what they were doing was, well, we can't do everything at once. We have to start somewhere. So we'll start with this aspect of the Torah Mecha. And hopefully, as we get people more deeply connected, more rooted in what Yiddishkeit is all about, then we'll grow. And it wasn't until the Divrei Chaim came along, the great Sanz Rav, who put such a tremendous emphasis on what it means to be a halachic Jew, at the same time that we value and we recognize all the importance of the experiential also. So it ended up working out. And nowadays, as we know, the Hasidic communities are no less halachic and religious than anyone else's. It's not just about the flavor. Yes, I'm sure there are many who are just about that. But that's not what they're about anymore. It's about understanding the Torah's Imecha at the same time that we recognize what the Musar Avicha means. And our community has a struggle in the opposite direction. We have become so intellectual. We have become so thirsty for knowledge. We have become so grounded and rooted to a text that we no longer care in many instances about what the Masorah means to us, about what the experience is supposed to be. If it's not chapter and verse like we said last week, then it's meaningless. If you can't point to a line in Shulchan Aruch, then it doesn't exist. It's a challenge in the opposite direction. But it's the same challenge. It's the same challenge of neglecting one of these two Masorahs. It's exactly what Rav Soloveitchik described. It's understanding, it's appreciating that we always have the Musar Avicha, the strict letter of the law that cannot be circumvented under any circumstances, while at the same time not being so rigid, not feeling like we're just boxed in, making sure we feel the experience. We keep the Shabbos, we don't walk out of the tchum, we don't cook, we don't do this, we don't do that, but does Shabbos mean anything to us? Do any of the mitzvahs that we perform have a meaning? Who can deny the fact that we go to Yerushalayim on an Erev Shabbos? We don't feel that kind of experience here in America on Erev Shabbos. It's not an indictment on anyone, but it's the reality. It's true. We're missing so much of the experience. I love being in Yerushalayim just for that. If nothing else alone. Just for that alone, it's worth it. To feel the experience of the mitzvahs that we do. You walk in the street on a Friday night, you can't deny the presence and the feeling of Shabbos. You can't run away from it if you tried. And it's something that we're missing. It's the Torah Simecha. Maybe we're stricter in the way we keep Shabbos. Maybe we're more careful. It could be. Maybe we might understand the Hilchos Shabbos better. Maybe we might know how to find it in Shulchan Aruch more properly than others might be able to, but we're also lacking. We're lacking the convergence of those two mesorot, of making sure that they always come together and they always synthesize each other. Look on the bottom of the first column. The laws of Shabbos, for instance, three lines from the bottom, were passed on to me by my father. So he learned all of Maseches Shabbos with his father, all of Hilchos Shabbos with his father, and he knew Hilchos Shabbos inside and out. The laws of Shabbos, for instance, were passed on to me by my father. They are part of Musar Avicha. But the Shabbos as a living entity, as a queen, was revealed to me by my mother. It is part of the Torah Simecha. The fathers knew much about Shabbos. The mothers lived the Shabbos, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. And without that, Shabbos would not have meant anything to Rav Soloveitchik. He had on the one hand the tradition from his father, the compliance to the law, but at the same time, his mother taught him how to experience Shabbos, what it means when Shabbos is here. What does it mean to have the Shabbos HaMalka, the presence of Shabbos in one's home? The fathers taught generations how to observe the Shabbos. The mothers taught generations how to greet the Shabbos and how to enjoy her 24-hour presence. The Rebbetzin, as I mentioned before, was one of the few women to whom the maternal Mesorah, the Toras Imecha, was entrusted. She represented the Mesorah community with great loyalty and dedication. She was a devoted good keeper of the treasure, which was put in escrow with her, and she knew how to guard it and how to transmit it to another generation. The Mesorah is an escrow with all of us. We are expected to guard it and to transmit it, unadulterated transmission, without any agenda, to the next generation. It's not ours. It was entrusted to us. It's in escrow. God believed that we can do the job, that we can do it properly, that we can do it with faith and with resilience, even at times when it's hard. She taught, like my mother, how to feel the presence of God. She taught to appreciate mitzvahs and spiritual values, to enjoy the warmth of a dedicated life. In a word, she taught everything which is included in the Torah Simecha. Quite often when I extended a good Shabbos greeting to her, I used to think of the great women throughout the ages who represented with wisdom, greatness, and dignity the Torah Simecha. So he's saying that when he encountered someone who was a part of that Mesorah, he felt that he was communicating not with that individual person, but with generations who that person represented. When he said a good Shabbos to Mrs. Twersky, he wasn't saying good Shabbos to her. He was wishing a good Shabbos to all the incredible women that upheld the Mesorah for so many generations. They were all there in that encounter, in that experience. Consciously or unconsciously, I greeted not only her, but her mother, her mother's mother, the entire community of mothers who kept our tradition alive. I felt as if all of them had been assembled in the dining room of the Rebbetzin, as if Shabbos HaMalka herself had been present there. The room looked the way I imagined Sarah's tent must have looked. It was enveloped in a cloud. There was a burning candle, and there was the Shekhinah. That's what Mesorah should mean to all of us. We represent something that is so much larger than life, that is so much greater than any individual person. We represent that which speaks for so many generations, for so many thousands of years. And when we listen to someone who is a representation of that, when we encounter someone who stands for all of that with courage and with humility at the same time, we recognize that we're having an encounter with not just that person, but with Moshe Rabbeinu himself, with Yehoshua ben Nun and the Shivim Zakenim, with all the mothers and their mothers who came before them. And we uphold a Mesorah that is so valuable and is the greatest treasure of what it means to be a God-fearing and religious Jew. In the next part of this year, I think what I'm about to do is a little bit, I thought it was dishonest. I called my father yesterday to discuss it with him. I read this piece from Rav Soloveitchik a number of years ago. And I'll be honest with you, I think that the first half of the piece, it spoke very much to me. It was very powerful to me. The second half, I guess I'm not intellectual enough to appreciate. It was very philosophical, way above my head. So I invite everyone to read it on their own. I didn't put it on here. But I want to use the beginning of this as a point of departure, because I think the argument and the question that he makes is a very important one. It's one that was powerful to me. And I think it's one that really speaks to the issue that we're trying to raise in our shiurim here about minhag and mesorah. Yeah. I don't think he means strange as in weird. I think he means strange as in people around look at you and say, really, that's what you're following? How many people in our world look at us and say, really, you still believe in that? What?
Because you have to understand Austin society at that time was a very controversial place. They were fighting a fight, and the fight was very dirty. Very dangerous.
I don't think he means condescending. I think he means the way people looked at them was just, who are you people? You're people of the book? You really believe in this? I think that's what it is. I think that's what he means. So, the reason I want to get into the next part of the shiur is for the following. I'll read to you some recent, I hope it's jarring to all of you, pronouncements that were made by rabbis in recent weeks. And again, this is not at all a condemnation of them. I think this is just a response from Rav Soloveitchik to some of the very frightening messages that have been given over in the last couple of weeks. So he writes as follows. I'm not saying who it is, because it's not important who it is. I'm not here to attack him at all. I don't care about what he teaches his people. I care that our people should not be challenged by this. The only way I can morally justify reading Megillas Esther as a religious experience on Purim is to assume that the text is mere religious imagination or political satire emerging from a culture of powerlessness. When this person was put to task for what he said, he then clarified the statement. Let us bracket that the story implies that they killed men, women and children too. Even if it was just the men, as some are claiming, do we really want to celebrate a mass extermination done out of, I'm missing a word here, something. And he writes, this is scary stuff. I think being religious means, and here is where I think there's a great mistake. And this is what I think is worthy of discussing. I think being religious means that we must only accept religious teachings that are just and holy and openly reject religious teachings of hate, violence, and revenge. Being religious means rereading texts in line with our moral conscience that God has placed within us, not blindly submitting to literal reads that contradict our most basic moral intuitions. Number three, approaching Purim, should building a third temple be our highest religious aspiration? Hold on. After the buzz of a glass of wine or two, this was sent to me by members of our shul, and that's why I'm talking about it. After the buzz of a glass of wine or two, I may be able to celebrate such a utopian idea where there could be a central location where the Jewish people could come to embrace the revealed, radiant light of God and selflessly give ourselves to divine service. But in a sober state of moral responsibility, the proposed dream of having a Beis HaMikdash, which by the way we daven for many times a day, appears to be a nightmare. A nightmare. Centralization upends diversity. Priestly religion topples sage religion. Pious submission upsets intellectual religion. Patriarchy suppresses equality. Physical matter is celebrated over spiritual life. Fundamentalists become celebrated over spiritual life. Fundamentalists become the gatekeeping authorities. We regress back to mass animal sacrifice. We displace Muslims from the Temple Mount. God forbid. Speeches today should not end with "B'mehera b'yameinu, may we build the temple speedily in our days," but with "may we eradicate pain, suffering speedily in our days." Can we learn to dream collectively again? Now this is, again, might be one way of thinking. but it totally rejects the Mesorah that we stand for. And I think he comes from a tremendous dilemma. And it's a dilemma that we all face. And that's what Rav Soloveitchik points out in this piece here. How does someone come to make such a statement? I don't think people are evil. I don't believe that. I think people mean well. I think sometimes they're mistaken. And where does such a mistake come from? And when I read that, I was reminded of Rav Soloveitchik's piece that I read a number of years ago called Majesty and Humility. And again, we're just going to take the beginning of the piece, and then we're going to veer off on our own to make the point that I think is relevant to this. So let's begin. Man is a dialectical being. An inner schism runs through his personality at every level. Man is a great and creative being because he is torn by conflict and is always in a state of ontological tenseness and perplexity. So we live a life of tension. David HaMelech says in Tehillim, and this is a pasuk that we're all familiar with because we say it in Hallel, Ani amarti bechavzi kal ha'adam kozev. How do you translate that sentence? What does it mean? I said in my haste, all men are liars. Men doesn't mean men as opposed to women. It means all of humanity are liars. So what does that mean? What kind of lie did David HaMelech have in mind when he hurled this serious accusation at man in general? Did he have in mind the lie which the I tells the thou? Do you really believe that everyone that you have a relationship with is dishonest? Is living a life of a lie? I would hope we don't believe that. Yes, we identify people in life who we might want to stay away from because they might not be living an honest lifestyle. But for the most part, I think we believe that most of the people that we encounter, that we have relationships with, are honest and upstanding citizens. Did he refer to the everyday social lie? Did he refer to the commercial lie of the dishonest businessman, to the political lie of the faithless ruler, to the judicial lie of the perjurer? In a word, did he speak of the profitable immoral lie? Does man indeed engage constantly in immoral lying? By no means. We don't live life assuming that to be true. We don't accuse everyone who we speak to of living a double life, of being dishonest. So what does he mean? Ani amarti bechavzi kal ha'adam kozev. Every man, every part of humanity is living a lie. The psalmist David HaMelech is concerned with a different kind of lie. The existential lie that man tells not others, but himself. It's the conflict, it's the lie that we all live with. It's the inner struggle that we have. Let's see how he portrays this. Man is indeed a liar because he is involved in unresolvable contradiction, in an insoluble dialectic. We are stuck in some way. And here Rav Soloveitchik explains where that came from. Why are we stuck and where does this challenge emanate from? There are two objectives which moral man pursues. Man is quite often a captive of two enchanting visions, summoning him to move in opposite directions. He is attracted by opposing norms, by two sets of values. Two stars infinitely distant from each other beckon to him. Man must decide which alternative to take, which route to choose, and which star to follow. And here, says Rav Soloveitchik, is where the problem comes from. When Adam HaRishon, when the first man was created, the Pasuk says in Parshas Bereishis, Vayitzar Hashem Elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adama. God created man from the dust of the earth. Adama, ha-adama, the earth. What is the earth? Where? Which part of the earth? So the Medrash has two opposing views of where man was created from. And Rav Soloveitchik is going to argue that this is not two descending views, but these are two views that are both true. And man was created with both of them. And that's what creates our tremendous challenge. That's what creates our, what he calls, unresolvable contradiction that is inside of each and every one of us. Number one, says the Medrash, what does it mean that man was created min ha'adama? Number one, sabar afaro mikol ha'adama me'arba ruchos. Man was taken from a little sampling of dust from every part of this cosmos. The Ribono Shel Olam, God, took a little speck of dust from all different parts of the world, all different parts of the universe, and with that, he infused them with life and created man. Medrash number 2. Davar Acher. Natal Afaro Mimakom Shenemar Bo Mizbach Adama Ta'aseli. God created man not from the Adama of the entire cosmos, not from taking dust and earth from different parts of the universe, but rather he zeroed in on the Afar Minha Adama. What is that Adama that he refers to? The Adama in Parshas Yisro, where we're told, Mizbach Adama Tasali, make an altar for me on the Makam HaMikdash. It was from that very spot that the dirt was taken to create the first man. Now these are two different opinions in the Medrash, but here argues Rav Soloveitchik, both of them are true. And this is what makes man live in the insoluble dialectic, like he writes, that we're all faced with, that we're all living through. Man was created of cosmic dust. God gathered the dust of which man fashioned from all parts of the earth. Indeed, from all the uncharted lanes of creation. Man belongs everywhere. He is no stranger to any part of the universe. His intellectual curiosity is of cosmic, universal dimensions. He wants to know not only about the things that are close to him, as for example the flowering bush in his backyard, but also about things that are far removed from him, things and events millions of light years away. Human cosmic inquisitiveness borders almost on the arrogant. It doesn't mean that in a condescending way, but why is it our business what's happening in space? That's the natural disposition of a human being, to explore. Like the Pasuk says, Redu ba'aretz v'kivshuha. The challenge of man is to conquer the world and understand it, explore the world. That's what we were asked to do in the very outset of creation. And that's something we are still asked to do, to explore and engage the world in every possible way we can. Man is cosmic through his experiential involvement. Man is cosmos-oriented not only intellectually, but emotionally as well. He loves the cosmos. He in person wants to be everywhere. Man is questing not only to know the universe, but also to experience it. Meaning, it's not good enough that we send up a launcher to give us information about the universe, but we're going to go ourselves. We have that desire, we have that need to experience it on our own. To see what it is, even though it might be at a great personal loss. We have lost lives over these kinds of missions. But that's what man always wants to do, to explore, to understand, to see it, to experience it. He feels bored by the monotony and the routine of familiar surroundings. He is out to see the world. Man is not satisfied sending up unmanned vehicles to gather scientific data. He is eager to do it himself. He wishes to move with the velocity of light into a world of the unknown. Man wants to experience and to enjoy vastness. That's what it means, says of Soloveitchik, we are created afar min ha'adama. The reason why we have that natural predisposition to explore, to engage, to understand, to examine, to be a part of everything, to put ourselves into all facets of creation and humanity is because we were created from so many different facets of creation. We were taken afar min ha'adama from so many different particles of the universe, and God put it in us. That's natural for us to want to do that because that's the way we were created. Now we come to Medrash number 2. Let us examine the other interpretation of the verse in Bereshis. Man was created from the dust of a single spot. Man is committed to one locus. The Creator assigned him a single spot he calls home. Man is not cosmic. He is here-minded. He is rooted being, not cosmopolitan but provincial. A villager who belongs to the soil that fed him as a child and to the little world in which he was born. We were created from the Mizbach Adama, from one single place, from one single spot. Yes, man may roam along the chartered and uncharted lanes of the universe. He may reach for the skies. Yet the traveler, the adventurer out to conquer infinity, will surely return home. The dust of which man was fashioned was not taken from all parts of the universe, according to the Medrash, but from a single spot on a mountain where an altar was, many, many years later, constructed. As we said before, each man is created from and attached to a single spot, the origin from which he cannot escape. The home for which man yearns attracts him like a powerful magnet. It brings him back no matter how far he has traveled. Occasionally, when I am at the airport, I happen to observe the loading of a double coffin containing the body of a Jew who has lived, worked, raised children, prospered or failed in the United States. It is being shipped for burial in the land of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. The mystery of the origin apparently casts a spell even upon people who have few religious commitments. How often do you see that somehow they're drawn to their roots, they're drawn to Eretz Yisrael? The modern secular Jew wants to rest in eternal peace in proximity to the site where the patriarchs found their rest. So you can go online and find the rest of this piece, and I'm sure you'll find it meaningful. But I think it's worthy of using this for our point here. What can lead a person to say that our moral consciousness nowadays does not allow us to read the Megillah with a serious tone? What can lead someone to say that the moral and societal norms that we expect ourselves to believe in nowadays prevent us from believing that there will be a Melech HaMashiach, that there will be a Beis HaMikdash, that we will once again have a central authority and a place where all will come to serve the Ribono Shel Olam in unison, in harmony? What can get a person to say such a thing, to believe in that? I think it's the fact that every human being is created with this very difficult challenge. On the one hand, we are created afar min ha'adama. We are created in a way where we have an interest in being engaged with every part of the universe, with being an actual part of our society, with being integrated in society, with making sure we are contributing to every part of this universe. And when we have that perspective, which is a natural perspective and a natural desire because that's the way we were created, says R. Soloveitchik, it's very hard to divorce ourselves and to reattach to that Mizbach Adama, to that part of us that was created from underneath the Mizbeach, to the Mesorah, to the tradition. Those stand in contrast with one another. They do not jive. Yes, we believe in equality in our society. Why is it that we should say in our society that the laws should be different for different segments of the population? We don't believe in that. And yet we are challenged when it comes to religion that not everything that society expects and not everything that society teaches us is morally and ethically correct is going to be able to fit with our second side, which is the Mizbach Adama, the part of us that was created from the Makam HaMizbeach, that is rooted in one single spot, in the Mesorah, the tradition that we uphold, that we stand by, and that we so much value and respect. That's the challenge that every human being lives with. And this, says Rav Soloveitchik, is what it means, Kol HaAdam Kozev. Every human being lives, in some way, a lie. Because we live with contradictions. And they're contradictions that cannot be solved. And yes, it's hard for all of us that are integrated in society in some way. And again, this is not a judgment on any other community, but in some way it's easier to cloister ourselves away, make pretend the internet doesn't exist, make pretend like there's no outside world. In some way that's easier. But for those of us that don't do that, it's very difficult. It's a tremendous challenge. We do go out into the world, and we have professions, and we do try to explore, and we do try to understand science, and we want to be integrated, and we want to have as much contribution as possible from our community as any other wants. But with that comes that tremendous challenge. Don't get carried away. Because you always have to remember that there are those two parts of every human being that were created at the same time. There's on the one hand what the Medrash says, Savar afaro mikal ha'adama mi'ar baruchos. God took particles of dust from all over the world in order to form and create the first man, but at the same time, At the same time, God also created man with that need to be connected to spirituality, to be rooted in a Mesorah, to be firmly grounded in tradition. And those are always going to be at odds with one another. Like Rav Soloveitchik said when we started this, it's the unresolvable contradiction that every man, that every human being has to live with and has to grapple with and has to figure out how they are going to draw the perfect balance. So to come to such a conclusion, again, it's not what our community believes in, I would hope. But to come to such a conclusion, I think, comes from just a very slight imbalance. We allow sometimes our other side of ourselves to take over. And it's painful to watch it happen. But it's the challenge that we all face. Are we not bothered? In our society, we know, we don't punish without a good reason. We cannot incarcerate someone without them really being guilty of doing something. We believe in a justice system, and we look in religion and we wonder, as all the great Jewish philosophers have asked and have wondered throughout all the millennia, Tzadik v'ralo. How does Judaism justify reward and punishment? We have no understanding of that. It does not fit with our social and moral consciousness that we live with today. And so many other examples are true of how we're pulled in opposite directions, and it's the job of the human being to figure out how not to have a schism in life, but how to jive both of those tremendous contradictions, those tremendous conflicting feelings that are a part of every one of us, and make ourselves, number one, a part of society, make sure we are integrated, make sure we take advantage of all that the world is out here to teach us and to influence us, but at the same time, to remind ourselves of the importance of Mesorah, to remind ourselves of the importance of the Mizbach Adama, of that firmly rooted standing that we are all meant to have in the Makom HaMizbeach. That's what Judaism is all about. And without that, said Rav Soloveitchik, I could have learned everything there is to learn. You can be scholarly. You can study every pasuk in Chumash, every Gemara, every Mishnah, every Halacha there is to know. You can know every commentator. But if you're missing that aspect of the human experience, if you don't have the Torah Simecha that goes along with the Musar Avicha, with the strict letter and compliance to the law, you are missing everything that Judaism is meant to be experienced, is meant to be lived. And this is why Mesorah, why tradition, why Minhagim are so important. Because without it, we have half of the religion. We have, Rav Soloveitchik said, two Mesorahs that we're expected to always keep to. The strict compliance to the law and the experiential feeling of what the law is supposed to make us experience as well and make us feel. Shabbos is not just what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. It is feeling the presence of the Shechina. And this is so much of what Mesorah represents. As Rav Soloveitchik said, when he met someone who embodied that Mesorah, he felt that he was engaging not with that person, but with so many generations of that person who represented the very same. When we listen to the Torah that is shared by the greats of our generation, when we follow the Psak of the greats of our generation, we are following not the psak of that person. We are following the psak of Moshe Rabbeinu, of the Shivim Zakenim, of Rabbi Kiva Eger, of the Minchas Chinuch, of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Rama, of everybody else that came in between. It's a powerful imagery, and it's meant to be powerful because we have a powerful and a strong, vibrant Mesorah. It's something that we met before, was entrusted with us. It doesn't belong to us to do whatever we want with it. It was entrusted with us. It is something that was given to us as a gift. Something that God said, I know that you will be the ones to transmit this properly. To give it down to your children the way I gave it to you. And the way your parents gave it down to you and your teachers and your masters have transmitted it. And that is our job, that is our task. In a world where there is so much confusion about what the Mesorah, what tradition actually means to us, at least for ourselves, to remind our community, to remind those who we engage with, that Mesorah is something we hold as such a valuable asset to all that we believe in, to all that we practice, and to all that we do. Any questions?